Machine on. Okay. Good afternoon. This is the first of a new series which will go through the whole year until next summer, Be'ezrat Hashem, on the Rambam's Yud Gimel Ikre. We need to give a couple of introductory sessions just to understand why we're talking about this, what are the Ikrim, why are they important, what do people think they are, why are they mistaken, and all sorts of things like that. And therefore what I'm going to do today is really give you an introductory class. There will be part two of this introductory class, which will happen 2 weeks from now, because next Monday I'm not here, and then we'll get into the Ikrim after that and start going through them. Now, please feel free to ask questions. There'll be a lot of material today which is new to people. So please ask questions. We can take it easy and slowly on this. The Rambam, in fact, is going to tell us in a minute to take it slowly, and we're going to follow his advice. Let's give an introduction to the introduction. Everybody knows there's lots of mitzvahs in the Torah, and most of them have some bearing on what people do. Do this, don't do that. Some of them have a bearing on what people say, how you say things and what not to say and what yes to say. But a number of mitzvahs refer to and apply to how people think, how you're meant to think, how I'm meant to think, our conceptions of God and what we're not meant to think, and different things like that. Now, translating those into a belief system is what the Rambam is going to do here. At different stages in Jewish history, and we'll talk a little bit more as we go through the course about historical context, because that's really important. At different stages in Jewish history, it became more or less important to work out what people believe. You alright, Meira?
Oh, I need a story back.
Okay. It became more or less important to work out what people believe. At certain points in Jewish history, people were required to kind of put their faith on the line. Well, what do you believe? What do you think? And on many occasions, if they thought the wrong thing, they were in trouble. At certain stages in the Middle Ages, during the growth of Islam, when the Islam became very dominant and the Jews were put on the spot and were demanded, do you believe in Islam? What do you believe? Later on, in more recent times, in the last 200 years, with the growth of Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism, people again have been having to kind of justify, well, what do you believe? Do you believe in this or do you believe in that? At other stages in Jewish history, people haven't been that bothered what people believe as much as what people do. And we'll talk more about that. But the Rambam, really, for the first time, and when I say the Rambam, let's make it clear. The Rambam and the Ramban are two different people. And they always get confused because their names are so similar. The Rambam, Rabbeinu Moshe ben Maimon, usually is the emphasis on the beginning of the word. The Rambam, okay, Maimonides is his Latin name. The Ramban, Moshe ben Nachman, or Nachmanides, lived about 100 years later in Spain. The Rambam was born in Spain, but he lived most of his life in Egypt. Two different people coming from different schools of thought in many ways. We're going to be dealing almost entirely, Gabby, with the Rambam, Maimonides here, and understanding his system of thought. Maimonides, has anyone ever been to the kever, the grave of the Rambam?
No.
In Tiberias? Yeah. There's something written on the grave of the Rambam. Does anyone remember what it is? Close. Yeah, exactly. Mimosha ad Moshe, Loikam Kamosha, from Moses, i.e. Moshe Rabbeinu, who received the Torah on Sinai. We talked about that yesterday, what that means, or we started to talk about that. To Moshe ben Maimon, no one ever lived like Moshe ben Maimon, which is an amazing thing to say. They didn't write that on anybody else's tombstones until later, when that became a popular kind of thing to write. But from Moshe Rabbeinu until Moshe ben Maimon, there was never anybody. All the years of the Bible, all the years of the Talmud, all the years of the Mishnah and the Gemara. The Rambam, who lived in the late 1100s in, as I say, in Spain and Egypt, was the most important Jewish person in the world from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu pretty much until his own time, and perhaps even until our time. It's very hard to overestimate the impact that the Rambam had on Halacha. Most of the Shulchan Aruch is based to a large degree on the Psak of the Rambam. We'll talk more about that in our oral law class as we go through the year. But in Hashkofa, in ideas, the Rambam is king. He's the head and shoulders above everybody else. By the way, the expression head and shoulders, You heard that expression before? It's a shampoo, right? Why is it called Head and Shoulders? Who was Head and Shoulders above everybody else? No, close though. Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech is described in the Tanakh as Head and Shoulders above everybody else. That's where the shampoo got its name from. Yeah, but they please play on words because it's an expression in English, Head and Shoulders. Yeah, I'm telling you, you look into the marketing. Head and Shoulders above the rest existed as an expression long before the shampoo was invented. So it's a play on words because it's actually dangerous. Exactly, it's a clever marketing thing, yeah? Okay, it's not for now. It's off the topic. You're looking skeptical, okay? You don't have to take it. It's not sack. You can look into it and make up your own mind. Anyway, the Rambam, however, let's get back on the point. The Rambam was way ahead of the pack. And in fact, he was the first on this particular issue. Have a look in source number one. The Abarbanel, who lived a few hundred years after the Rambam, also Sephardi, also from Spain. He lived in the late 1400s. And the Rambam was in the late 1100s, so 300 years later. The Abarbanel wrote a book, probably one of the most important early books, on the Yud Gimel Ikrim, on the Rambam's principles of faith. And he writes the following. The first person to begin positing principles and foundations of the divine Torah was Maimonides. In his commentary to Peir Chelik of Tractate Sanhedrin of the Mishnah, all Israel have a portion in the world to come. Now there's a few important things to get out of that. First of all, he makes the point that really before the Rambam, nobody had ever done this. Even through all the days of the Gemara, the Mishnah, and the Gemara, and the Talmud, nobody had ever systematically set down, these are the things that a Jew must believe, and if you don't believe these things, either you're not Jewish, or you're not religiously Jewish, or what implications that has, we'll see next time what the implications are for this. One second. But it seems that Rambam was the first one to do this. And again, we have to ask ourselves the question as we go through, why? Why did nobody want to do this or think of doing this before? Did they understand this as obvious? Did the Rambam just record it but everyone knew it? Or did the Rambam innovate it in some way and develop this as a new system of thought? Someone have their hand up. Aviva. Yeah. There may be an older one on the website, but I am already recording it, so it will be. So yeah, someone else had a question. At the back. Someone had a yes, Courtney, yes.
Necessarily like a good thing that
it is a good thing. It is, or you're not sure it is.
And, like, I'm not sure. Like, I feel like maybe there was a reason they didn't do it before. Like,
right.
They didn't want an absolute. This is what you have to do to be a good Jew. Like,
So we'll have to talk about that. We will have to talk about that next time in part two of the introductory classes to this. I'd like to talk about why maybe the Rambam felt that he needed to do it and why people haven't done it before. But the first thing that the Abarbanel says is that he was the first person to really do it. Now, that's not to say the Rambam makes it up. The Rambam bases everything he says, as he always does, on people that came before him, either on the Gemara or in some cases on Aristotle and basic natural philosophy and understanding of logic, which he's going to talk about as we go through it, largely on the Gemara though. The Rambam holds that really the Jews were all philosophical and they lost it. Okay, you can agree or disagree with that. We'll talk more about that later. But the Rambam's not making it up. He's the first to codify it. Yes.
Is that how it's justified to have dogma?
Yes. We're talking about dogma here. He was the first one really to write down the dogma of the Jews. Now, where did he write it? So he mentioned here Perich Chelik of Tractate Sanhedrin of the Mishnah. Let me give you a little bit of background to that. The Mishnah, we'll talk more about it in our oral law class, is the basic written version of the oral law, which was produced around 1,000 years before the Rambam. In the Mishnah there is a volume called Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin deals with courts, court procedure, court systems, and the death penalty in certain different ways. And the last chapter of the Tractate Sanhedrin is called Perik Chelek, a chapter called Chelek, which starts with the words Kol Yisrael Yesh Lehem Chelek La'olam Haba, very famous words. That all the Jewish people, every Jew has a place in the world to come. But of course, the bit that people don't remember or don't want to remember is the next line, which says, but these people, these groups of people, have no place in the world to come. The Rambam wrote a commentary on the Mishnah. He was one of the first also to do that. Even though the Mishnah was already 1,000 years old, people had written bits and pieces on the Mishnah. But the Rambam, leaving aside the Talmud, wrote a commentary just on the Mishnah. And he wrote it on every book of the Mishnah. When he got to this chapter, rather than jumping into his commentary, he said, first, I want to write an introduction to Perek Chelek. And in this introduction, where the Rambam explains what is the world to come, who does get the world to come, who doesn't get the world to come, the Rambam decided there to write his 13 principles of faith. His 13 yisodot. Yisod is a foundation, that's what he calls them. Or he actually doesn't call them that, we'll see why in a minute. Or ikrim, what's the word ikrim mean?
Matter.
Not really matter.
Inyan.
Yeah, ikar is the main thing. And ikar is like a root or a main sort of aspect for something. So that's where the Rambam wrote them. So that's the first important thing to remember, and we'll go over it a bit later. When people talk about the Yud Gimel Ikrim, most people, I'm not talking about most people who don't know about Judaism, most from people who grow up their entire lives and know about these things, or some do, some don't, you ask them, what are the Yud Gimel Ikrim? They'll say, oh yes, the Ani Ma'amins. That is not true. The Ani Ma'amins, we'll see later, are a later summary of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, and they don't say exactly what the Rambam said. And the Rambam didn't write them. The real Yud Gimel Ikrim are much more complex, and they're found, as I say, in the Rambam's introduction to this particular chapter, Sanhedrin. We're going to deal with it. We're going to go through it. We're going to go through each one. We're going to read what the Rambam says. They're not long, particularly. Each one's about a paragraph. We're going to read what the Rambam says as we go through each Ikka, and then we're going to talk about it, describe it, and bring other sources from other places. Okay? So that's the first thing to understand. Let's just look as another introduction at number two. Number two is the Rambam's final words on the Yud Gimel Ikrim. Source number two, because I want you to see what he says. He's going to give us some guidelines as to how to learn this. And these are nice words. Have a look here, number two. V'hine, herachti hadvarim ma'id. I've gone on at length about this, and he has, because let's face it, he's writing a line-by-line commentary on the Mishnah, and he's decided to take time out and write a whole essay on these issues to do with the world to come, and now he's telling you why. Herachti hadvarim ma'id. I've gone on at length about these things. V'yatsati Me'inyan ha'chiburi, and I've digressed from the real, meat, the real issues that I'm my commentary on the Mishnah. Why? Why have I done that? Aval asiti zeh, I have done this l'mashe re'isi bo ta'elis be'emun, because I found there to be a very great importance to this, a value to this in matters of emuna, of belief. We have to define the word emuna. What does emuna mean? What does it not mean? Lots to say about that. I gathered together for you many effective things, which we're going to see, very useful ideas, scattered around many different publications, and again, we're going to talk about the Talmud, we're going to talk about Aristotle, Plato, all sorts of things. He's giving you a brocha, and that's why I wanted to bring this to the beginning, because we need a brocha to learn this for a year. Hatzlach behem, he says, do well. Hatzlach rabba, he says, try hard. V'chazor al dvarai ele pamim rabot. Go over this many times. Don't just read this through once. Like you go to a shir, and you come out of the shir, and you say, how was the shir? Oh, it was fantastic. It was inspiring. It was amazing. What did he say? I don't know. Like, how many times have you been to a shir where you come out, it was a great shir, but you have no idea what was said? I'm sorry to break it to you, but that is not a very useful exercise. It might keep you from one day to the next. But which in itself, I suppose, is some value. But it won't give you any material. The Rambam says, don't just come to this and kind of walk out again saying that was great. Go over it many times. The hitzbonen behem, hitzbonenut tova. Be mitzbonen. Think about it. Ponder on it. Consider it. Very, very much. The in yisiyacha libcha, if your mind wants to tell you, ki hisigata inyanav, that you've really grasped it. From going over it once, or the Esther, or even 10 times. Hari Hashem Yodea, God only knows, he says, that you're lying to yourself. You're just deluding yourself. If you think you understood this after going through it once, or even 10 times, he says, this is really tough stuff. You need to think about it really hard. Out of my hair, boy, don't go too fast. Don't go too fast. Take it slowly, he says. I didn't just write it like the first thing that came into my head. I thought about it myself very hard, he says. But Yishuv Hadas, and I really focused on this. I find this very itself very inspiring. The Rambam, who was the most brilliant mind in Judaism, is telling us that he himself has thought very hard about this and has written it very carefully. The Iyun B'deyas Nechonus, I've worked out who had the right opinions, who built in the Nechonus and the wrong opinions. The Hasagas. The hasogas mashit sorif sheyami behem, and the things that a person needs to believe. The havas rayas, and I brought proofs. Batanas or hochachos and arguments. I'll call it inyan ve'inyan. I've not just said believe this. I brought you proofs. And we'll see his proofs, what he called proofs. Are they logical proofs? Are they textual proofs, etc.? Umi Hashem Eshal, I've asked from God, Lahan Chayseini B'derech Emes, to help me get it right. Now I get back to my commentary, he says. So I wanted to put these words at the beginning of the course because the Rambam gives us a bracha. He tells us how to learn it. He tells us to learn it slowly. Don't think you understood it. It's very complicated. And therefore, from the very beginning, you see this kind of idea of just repeating, I believe, Amim, Amin, I believe. It's like a dogma, like a catechism. Like, it's not what we're talking about. This idea that you say you believe these things, that's it. You believe in this, that's good enough, move on. That's not Judaism. That may be other religions, maybe, that you just say you believe it and that's good enough. Here you have to understand it, think about it, and really focus, contemplate it, and work hard on it. So that's the first thing. Now, what are the Yogi Ma'ikram? Yeah. So what are the questions?
It's not necessarily that. It's actions.
He's not talking about actions yet. He's not talking about actions. Every single one of these Yogi Ma'ikram is something that goes on only in your brain. It's a thought system. We'll define that and refine that a little bit more. But basically, it's understanding how God runs the world, how what God is, what Torah is, and all those kind of things. We'll see, of course, actions are critical. You can't just think and not do. You can't have beautiful... although the Rambam is going to say to you, if you believe in all these things and yet break all the mitzvahs, that's better than if you keep all the mitzvahs, mahadim and mahadim, but you believe the wrong things. And that's a very controversial statement. We'll see that in next time. The Rambam is going to say, if you break Shabbos and you eat treif, but you have the right emunas, you'll get a place in the world to come. But if you eat the most glad kosher food and you keep Shabbos on the highest level, but you believe the wrong things, you're finished. And we're going to have to see whether everyone agrees with that, whether and why the Rambam said that. But that's for next time. Feel free. Okay, fine. Now, what are you giving Ikrim? You should be able to memorize these things and know them off by heart before long. The Yudgimel Ikrim are the following. Let's just go through them very quickly. We're not going to describe what they are or define them. We're just going to understand the 13 of what they are. Number one, God is the creator and ruler of all things. Okay, there is a first cause. Things didn't just pop into existence. There is something which sustains them, and that is the thing that we call God. Okay? Number two, the God is one. God is not particular. He's not made up of parts. He doesn't have attributes. You can't describe God. God doesn't have moods. He doesn't have character traits. He doesn't have mood swings. He doesn't get happy and sad. He's not big and small. God is one thing only. We'll define what that means. Three, that God has no body. That there's no way of, in any sense, describing God in a corporeal, and he cannot be a corporeal being that has a body, and therefore limitations. Number four, that God is beyond time. There is no future and past. There is only one massive, all-pervading present when it comes to God. We'll talk about that again, which is very interesting. And after a while, you get your mind starts kind of getting blown away by the consequences of communicating with a being which is beyond time and going to a place in Olam Haba which is beyond time. It's very, very difficult to contemplate that. But that's part of the whole system here. Number five, that one may pray only to God. And in many ways, the first five form one unit. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are basically, what is God? How do I relate to God? How do I think about God? How do I connect with God? That's the first five. 6, 7, 8, 9 are the next unit. 6, 7, 8, and 9 all define not how we relate to God, but how God relates and gives us Torah. Number six, that all the words of the prophets are true, that there is a system of prophecy, of nevuah, where God communicates with human beings. What is nevuah? What isn't nevuah? What are prophets? Why do we not have them? Or do we have them today? That's part of what we need to talk about. Number seven, that Moshe Rabbeinu has a different level of prophecy, a different quality of prophecy, which is absolutely true. And that's how the Torah came to us, and more about that then. Number eight, that the entire Torah was given to Moses. Wasn't made up later, and we'll talk more about that obviously in our oral law course as well. Number nine, that the Torah will never be changed. So that's really Torah. 4, 6, 7, 8, and 9 have to do with Torah. Yes.
I have a question about verses 7. You said
yes.
6 says, so all the words of the prophets are true. And then what's the difference?
They're true and absolutely true. Okay, fine. It's my English. It's we'll see. The difference between 6 and 7 is that there's such a thing as Nevuah, and then Moshe Rabbeinu has a communication level with Hashem which is totally different from every other kind of Nevuah. And we'll see whether that's a quantitative or a qualitative difference, but I put the word absolutely true, but it's probably the bad translation. It's not meant to imply that the prophets are not really true. Fine. 10, 11, 12, and 13 are all aspects of how God runs the world. Number 10, that God knows everything that we're thinking and everything that we're doing. Number 11, that there are consequences to that knowledge and to our actions, and that we have choices that make a difference, that there is reward and punishment in this world, in the next world, we'll define it. Number 12, that the ultimate reward in this world is that God will bring Mashiach, or that we will bring Mashiach. How Mashiach works, really interesting, very important. And finally, 13, that the ultimate reward is the resurrection of the dead. Or is it, does the Rambam hold that that's the ultimate reward, the idea of people coming back to life? But all of 10, 11, 12, and 13 all deal with the issue of God running the world. So later people actually turn around and said, really, there are only three Ikrim. The Rambam divides them into 13, but there are these three groups, like I said. 1 through 5 are our relation and understanding of God. 6 through 9 are God's communication with mankind through Torah. And 10 through 13 are God's control of the world. Okay? Simple so far, nothing complicated yet. Turn over the page, please. Look at C and D. Where did the Rambam write them? Well, I already told you the main place, the commentary on the Mishnah, and I told you where and how he wrote that. There are other places that he wrote them. The Mishnah Torah, and maybe you can look at C in conjunction with D. The commentary on the Mishnah, the Rambam wrote when he was very young, in his 30s. The Mishnah Torah was the Rambam's main work on halakha. Okay? The Mishneh Torah was written by the Rambam when he was a bit older, in his 40s, almost in his 40s, and that is the work of Halacha. In that Mishneh Torah, which deals with all the halachic system from A to Z, yeah, he also includes certain halachot as they pertain to these 13 ikrim. Halachot of belief, for example, I put here Mishneh Torah in Hilchos Tshuva. And when it comes to tshuva, he talks about what is tshuva, and he talks about some of the things that people have to do tshuva for, some of the ideas that are wrong, and belief in God, and the system of Olam Haba, he talks about it there, but that's much more halachic. In Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, at the beginning of Mishnah Torah, where he defines the basic beliefs of Torah, he talks about it there, and in a few other places as well, which I've indicated on the sheet. The sheet's much more of a kind of, almost like a source book. You can take away and, look at it and go past what we say in the shir. Sefer HaMitzvot that the Rambam wrote is almost like an adjunct to the Mishneh Torah. He first listed the 613 mitzvot, then he wrote the Mishneh Torah. So he talks about some of these ikrim also in the Sefer HaMitzvot. And the last thing really is the Morin Nevuchim. The Morin Nevuchim is the third of the three big things the Rambam wrote. Again, you need to know this about the Rambam. The Rambam wrote three major works. His commentary on the Mishneh when he was young, which is where the introduction to the Mishneh and Perek Chelek is, and he wrote the ikrim. His Mishneh Torah, don't get the Mishneh Torah confused with the Mishnah, for 1,000 years apart, or with the Mishnah Berurah, or things like that, which is another 800 years later. The Mishneh Torah, which is the Rambam's halakha work, where he writes all the halakhas that exist in Judaism. And the third work was the Morin Nevuchim that he wrote right at the end of his life. Okay? The Morin Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, is a work of philosophy, which is seeking to guide you through the main philosophical ideas of Judaism, and he also refers to some of the Ikrim in the Morin Nevuchim as well. He wrote, finally, something called the Treatise on the Resurrection of the Dead, which we'll talk about when we get to Tchiyas HaMeisim, because he was accused of not really believing in Tchiyas HaMeisim, in the resurrection, and he had to write a whole essay to deal with it, but that he deals with there, and we'll talk more about that then. Now, the Yud Gimel Ikrim, I'll tell you in a second, he upgraded all through his life. In other words, he refers in his commentary on the Mishnah that he wrote when he was 30, there are references in that to the Morin Nevuchim that he wrote when he was 50. How? Because he went back later in life over the commentary on the Mishnah, and he kind of checked that he still agreed with it, and he, put in some references and cross-references. So according to almost everybody, the Rambam stuck to this idea that we believe in some kind of dogma, and that the Yud Gimel Ikrim are really what a Jew is required to believe. There is one opinion, Rav Gorin, which we'll mention later on in the course, who believes the Rambam actually changed his mind. The Rambam wrote the Yud Gimel Ikrim, and later in life decided he didn't believe that this was quite the same anymore. We'll talk about that. It's a bit of a kind of a das yochid, a kind of rogue opinion. Most people understand the Rambam stuck to this all the way through. Meiri, you had a question?
Yeah, is Morin
Nevuchim the Guide to the Perplexed? Yeah, Morin Nevuchim is the Guide to the Perplexed. So, they are the three main Rambam. This is very important basic knowledge, by the way, about Judaism, about the Rambam. I mean, I could give you, I give a history course in which I spend 3 sessions on the Rambam, not here, in another school, and we talk a lot about these books, but you need to know about these books, especially the Mishnah Torah and the Morin Nebuchim, but also here, especially for this course, the introduction on the Mishnah, to the Mishnah, the commentary on the Mishnah as well. Right, now. Hello. One more point before we talk about something a little bit different. A few words on translations. Each should say a few words on translations. This is an important point that people often forget. I'm sorry I don't have another sheet, but if you don't mind sharing with me, you know that's goodbye. A few words on translations. What language did the Rambam write in?
Yeah.
Right. The answer is Judeo-Arabic or Hebrew. He didn't speak Yiddish. Yeah? He didn't speak English. He spoke 2 languages. He spoke Arabic, which Judeo-Arabic is the kind of dialect of Arabic that the Jews spoke at the time. And of course he was fluent completely in Hebrew. He was beautiful, beautiful Hebrew. He wrote different books in different languages. The only book that he really wrote in Hebrew was his Halacha book, the Mishnah Torah, which he writes in beautiful, what they call Lashon HaZahav, the golden language of the Rambam. And he wrote that right because that's halakha. He thinks halakha should be in Hebrew. And there we have the original, of course, Hebrew. There are manuscripts. When I was at Oxford, the original manuscripts of the Rambam, Mishnah Torah, signed by the Rambam, is in the Bodleian Library in Oxford. Okay? You can request it. And there's a rule in the Bodleian Library. Whatever you request, even if they've got it down in the stacks or whatever, they'll bring it up for you. One of my friends is a bit chuspidic. He was doing some kind of PhD at Oxford. And he actually, I think more for fun than for anything else, actually asked to see it. He went into the Bodleian Library. As an Oxford member, you're entitled to be a member of the Bodleian Library. And he said, could you bring me up, please, the original manuscript of Rambam? And so they're very optimistic. Looked at it and said, yes, what would that be for? Then he said, I've been researching that. So the guy looked at him and they said, very good, sir, as they do. And he brought it up to him. And he plopped it on his desk like this. With his cup of coffee like this, like it's next to him. And he said, typical English, he said, do be careful, little chap, it's rather valuable. the coffee, you know. So he didn't do anything else. But it's there. We've got the mini manuscripts all in Hebrew of the Rambam. However, everything else that the Rambam wrote, he wrote in Arabic. Because he wrote it in the vernacular that Jews spoke at the time, which was Arabic. The Sephardi communities living in Spain, North Africa, they all spoke Arabic. So the 13 Ikrim, the Yud Gimel Ikrim, which are really in his commentary on the Mishnah, were all written in Arabic, not in Hebrew. So the first problem that we have when we learn the Yud Gimel Ikrim is to what did he actually write? Because, you know, I don't know about you, but if I start trying to teach this course in Judeo-Arabic, I'm going to get very far. I don't speak a word of Judeo-Arabic. Salam, probably, will get me somewhere. But further than that, I'm not going to get any further than that. And therefore, everything we're going to learn, apart from stuff from the Mishnah Torah, which is an original, everything we're going to learn is some kind of translation. And therefore, you're going to have to decide whose translation you're going to use. Now, anyone who knows anything about translation knows that every translation is also a commentary. You cannot translate a word without also kind of deciding what you think it means. And therefore, when we see the Rambam using words, we're going to have to realize that is this exactly what the Rambam meant? Gabby?
Just a question. Why does then possession of that?
Like,
how did they acquire it?
Oh, the Bodleian Library. Oxford and Cambridge libraries have been collecting manuscripts from all sorts of places all the way, you know, since time immemorial. How did they get them? They buy them.
They could have purchased that from where they
collectors. I don't know how they got their hands on the original Rambam. The big holders of manuscripts in the world are the Bodleian Library in Oxford especially, Cambridge to a lesser degree, and of course the Vatican. The church has enormous access to stuff, some of which it doesn't let anybody else see. Also, the Church of England. I'll tell you a funny thing. I digress, but I can't resist it now that you mention it. The King Henry VIII, remember him?
Yeah.
Big fat guy with 6 wives? Yeah. King Henry VIII, who lived sometime after the Rambam, he lived in the early 1500s, he commissioned a copy of the Shas, a very early print of the Shas called the Bomberg Shas, by a Jewish printer in, I think, in Italy called Bomberg. Maybe in Germany, I think it's Italy. And the Bomberg Shas was printed specifically for Henry VIII. Why did he want a copy of the Talmud? He didn't do Daf Yomi, I can assure you of that. Yeah? Why did King Henry VIII want a copy of the Talmud? Because King Henry VIII did a funny thing. He wanted to marry his dead brother's wife. Yibum. He wanted to effectively do Yibum, and the Catholic Church was a bit sniffy about it. I don't know. It's like, and therefore he basically, one of the things he did early in his life, because he liked the look of his brother's wife, I think he liked the look of it even when his brother was still alive, but that's a different question. He wanted to prove, based on Talmudic sources and Jewish, you know, thinking, that because the church knew all about this, that the Talmud, you know, with the whole tractate of Yevamos, etc., etc. Later, of course, he divorced that same wife, because he went off her, he went on someone else, and the church wouldn't have any of that, and the only way he could get away with that is by completely breaking away from the church and starting a new religion. So that's what he did, he started the Protestant church. But anyway, that's beside the point. So he had this Bombo Chas made. This Bombo Chas found its way into the hands, this is why I digress, of the Church of England. They ended up with this Bombo Chas. A man that I knew a little bit from London, wanted very much, a very big Jewish collector of Jewish antique manuscripts, antiquarian books, wanted to get hold of this, and he asked the Church of England many times. A man called Henry Lunzer, had the Lunzer connection. The whole Lunzer collection is actually in Sotheby's right now in New York, and is looking for a buyer, I think, still. So, amazing collection of books. He wanted this set of chaff for years, and he kept asking the Church of England, and they kept saying, oh no, we're not selling. How did eventually he get the Church of England to sell him the chaff? He managed, and I don't know how he did this, to get his hands on something that the Church of England wanted even more than Henry VIII's chaff. It was some, I don't know what it was, some original title deeds to the Westminster Abbey or something like that from him. How he got hold of it, I have no idea. That's what you ask. But anyway, he got it. And when he called up the church one day and said, oh, it's me again. He said, oh, no, we're not selling. And he said, you know, take a look at this on Skype and see what you think. Well, they didn't have Skype in those days. And when they saw that, they sort of started salivating, and they did a deal as quick as, you know, you can say. And he got his hands on the Bombo Chas. That's now part of the Lunzer connection. So who has all these manuscripts is a fascinating question. And they end up all over the world in different people's hands.
But this one in particular, like, a Jew must have sold this to a Christian institution.
I don't know. It's a good question. You could do a PhD thesis this on the history of the travels of the Rambam's original manuscripts. What happened? Did he go to his kids? Did then the kids sell it on to someone? I'm not sure.
Is it possible this was in the Cairo Geniza with a lot of other...
This was not in the Cairo Geniza, because the Cairo Geniza is mostly in Cambridge. And there's no way that Cambridge would have let Oxford get their hands on it.
Fair enough.
I can tell you that for a fact. But this was not in the Cairo Geniza. There's lots of stuff from the Rambam that was in the Cairo Geniza. 100%.
But this we
ended up with a lot before the Cairo Geniza. Again, the Cairo Geniza is the Cambridge thing. That's a whole different thing. Again, Solomon Schechter, a really fascinating story. There's a good book. If you're interested in the Cairo Geniza, there's a great book called Sacred Trash, which I read about a year ago, which I really recommend. It's very interesting. Right, let's go on. We digress too much. What time do we end the class? 6:10, perfect. So which translation are we going to use, guys? What are we going to use for a translation? So I brought you here on the bottom of page 2, the classic medieval translations. If you pick up a classic Rambam, don't have one here, there's upstairs, we've got lots of Rambams. In the back of, not the Rambam, sorry, the Gemara. In the back of the Gemara, in Tractate Sanhedrin, which we probably do have here. Yeah, here, let me just randomly find it for you. In the back of Tractate Sanhedrin, I was always clumsy, it's fine. My father said I'd grow out of it, but I never did. Thank you. In the back of the Rambam, in the back of the Gemara, rather, you will see... In practice, Sanhedrin, if they have it in this, one second. They bring. Thank you so much for helping this clear up my mess. Perfect. They usually bring the Rambam. Second. And in the back of the Rambam, you'll find the Yud Gimel Ishrei. Okay. Here we are. Oh no, that's not it. It's here somewhere, you can take my word for it, that here in the back of every Gemara there is a Hebrew translation of the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah, and also the Yud Gimel Ikrim that comes with it. Now, which translation did they use for that? So I brought you here on a few of the classic medieval translations, which were written by people like Rav Shmuel Ibn Tibbon. Okay, you can always remember his name, it sounds a bit funny. OK, Okay? The Ibn Timmons were great translators, and other people as well, the Abarbanel, and they were the classic early medieval translators from Arabic into Hebrew. The modern translations, and one of them is one I want to use, were written by modern scholars. There was a very, very important Maimonidean scholar called Rav Yosef Kapach. And if you haven't heard of him before, you need to hear of him now. He, in anyone who studies the works of the Rambam seriously, has to get to grips with Rav Kapach. He's a brilliant mind, a big Rav, a brilliant Talmudic mind from Yemen, a Yemenite. The Yemenites, by the way, were very into the Rambam. Do you know why?
Partly that.
But also, he wrote them a letter. They were having a very hard time being forced to convert and things. And the Rambam wrote them a very a big chizuk letter called the Igeret Teiman, which really told them, like, hold tight, guys, don't worry, because, you know, Mashiach's coming. And they were really excited by this. And they adopted the Rambam as their Rebbe Supremo. They even put his name into Kaddish. They changed the Kaddish and said, where we say, in your days and in the life of all the two people of Israel. And they put a B'chayin Moshe ben Maimon. They put his name in Kaddish. They were really into him. And therefore you find that some of the Yemenites were very big Maimonidean scholars. Rav Kapach is one of them. But the translation I will be using is not his. It's the most recent translation, and it's this one here, by a Rav called Rav Yitzchak Shilat. Rav Shilat is a contemporary figure. Rav Kapach died just a few years ago. Rav Shilat lives in Ma'ale Adumim, or at least he teaches there in the yeshiva there, and he produced what is generally understood to be the most accurate modern translation into modern Hebrew of the Arabic bits of the Rambam here of the Yom Kippur. So we will be using his translation. That's the one that my Rebbe recommends to be using, and that's therefore the one that we'll be using for these purposes. Just so you know that, so you understand where we're getting it from. Now, let's go over to page 3. Why 13? Why did he pick the number 13? Now you tell me, where have you come across the number 13 in other areas of Jewish thinking? 13 attributes of God. What they call the Yud Gimel Midot. The Moshe Rabbeinu is taught by God in Parshas Kisisa, with a golden calf, yeah? Which are Hashem, Kel Rachum, Vachanum. You know what I'm talking about? Erech, Hapayim, Rav Chesed, Be'emet. What do you say? Sphira is not really a 13. Oh, the Sphirot?
Yeah.
No, that's really a 10. That's a 7 or a 10, not a 13. Bar Mitzvah, okay. Well, 13 is obviously relevant for Bar Mitzvah. That's a good question, depending on how you count the tribes. The government is divided into two, so there are really 13 tribes. The number 13 comes up in a few cases. Have a look in source number 3. B'kama Dvarim Kedoshim, says the Maharsha. Maharsha is a 16th century commentator, says like this. B'kama Dvarim Kedoshim Matzinu Mispara Zeyu Gimel. In many areas of Jewish thinking, we find this area is number 13. Kegoin, Yud Gimel Midos Hashem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's the 13 Midos that you mentioned before. Yud Gimel Midos Shehatara Nidreshes Bahem, you didn't mention this, the 13 attributes through which the Torah is darshaned. We will talk much more about it in our oral law course. The 13 hermeneutical principles of Rabbi Ishmael. Kal v'chomer and Binyan Av and Zera Shav. We'll talk much more about that. If that's not familiar, don't worry, because it'll be more familiar from our Sunday class. The Gamma Rambam Hiniach Ikrim Kaminyan. And the Rambam therefore chose this number 13 in order to do that, in order to pick this number as a kind of a holy Jewish number. Of course, non-Jews don't like the number 13 for their own reasons about 13 apostles, 13th apostle, and all that kind of stuff. And therefore you end up often in England, they're terribly superstitious about this. I grew up in a town where there's no number 13 on the houses. The houses go from 11 to 15. Someone actually, from where I live, expressed surprise that I was placed on an aeroplane on row 13. I said, well, I mean, what do you think is going to happen to row 13? Yeah, they have no floor 13s, etc. So number for Jewish people, the number 13 is always associated with positive things. Yeah.
How do you know that he came up with the number first and didn't just decide that these were the principles?
So that's a good question. So I think the answer is he may have done that. In fact, have a look at source number 5. Have a look at source number 5. What's your name again?
Katie.
I think Katie's onto something a little bit. Sometimes the numbers, made to fit with the numbers. Have a look here, number 5. Were it not for the dependence on the verses, the number of principles will be smaller or greater than number 13. Here, the Rashbats. The Rashbats takes the view that really you can count lots of different principles. You could make more than 13, you could make less than 13. He feels that the Rambam picked 13 because actually there are 13 principles which have sources in verses in the Torah. We can debate whether there are others or not, but in other words, that's why he picked 13. And then he kind of made the number of principles fit around that, because he says if we counted only fundamental principles, we'd have only 3, like I said at the beginning, the 3 main categories. Whilst if we counted sub-principles, there would be more than 13. And not everybody agreed with this idea that there were 13 principles. The Abravanel felt that no, there are as many principles as there are mitzvahs. There are 613 principles. And by the way, even the number 613, like where do we get that number from? And how do we count mitzvahs? Do we count the mitzvahs and get to the number 613? Or do we start with the number 613 and try and work out how the mitzvahs fit into that number? It's kind of more the latter than the former, which is very interesting, because sometimes these numbers themselves have significance. Fine.
Who
did you
know
which government? The English guy. Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz. Yes, go on, please, tell me.
He was saying that most of his other writings are 14. Yeah.
Yes.
So he thinks that principle number 14 is free will, but since it's not something about Hashem, it's something about the belief in ourselves, he didn't put it.
That's very interesting. Do you know when he said this? Can you find out?
I read it in the Jewish Press.
Interesting. Okay, no, very good. I mean, I need to find out what he says, because I'm interested in what he says. I knew him quite well. What's saying here is that really the Rambam wanted 14 principles, and the 14th underset principle is freedom of choice. And one of our questions is going to be, why isn't freedom of choice one of the 13 principles? Now, I am going to suggest to you, with all respect to Dr. Kovitz, that it actually is. That freedom of choice is actually there in principle number 4, which we'll see when we get to principle number 4, based on the way... We'll talk about it when we get there.
Are they kind of like orders in a way, aren't they?
The mitzvahs. Some of them are mitzvahs explicitly.
Mitzvah of free will.
We'll talk about it. You can't have a mitzvah to believe in God either. Because if you don't believe in God, then you're not going to listen to that mitzvah to believe in God. And if you already believe in God, what's the point of a mitzvah to believe in God? So we'll talk about these kind of questions. Now, we're going to finish in the last 10 minutes with just a few words on different versions of the Ikrim, the 2 famous versions of the Ikrim that people know about. There are at least 94 medieval poems which were written based on the Yud Gimel Ikrim. It was such a popular motif in the medieval times, and I gave you a reference at the bottom to some book. You can look them all up and spend happy evening hours reading the 94 different versions of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, if you've nothing else to read in the evening. But the only 2 I'm going to mention are the 2 really famous ones, which are Ani Ma'amin and Yigdal. Ani Ma'amin is a poem which was written, all of which now the verses begin, Ani Ma'amin Be'emunah Shleima. I begin with it, I believe with a perfect faith. The famous one is Beviyat HaMashiach. Yeah, that they sang when they went into the gas chambers, that's a very famous one. But the Ani Ma'amins, if you look over on page 4, you'll see I've brought you an extract or a copy of the Ani Ma'amins. They're found in every single siddur. There's almost no siddur printed without the Ani Ma'amins. And again, like I told you at the beginning, if you ask most from people, what is your Yud Gimel Ikrim, they'll tell you the Ani Ma'amins, because that's what people are familiar with. I've translated them at the bottom. We will see. We don't know exactly who wrote the Ani Ma'amins. There are those who say that the Rambam himself wrote them. Seems very unlikely. They only surfaced in the 16th century, and we're not exactly sure who wrote them. But people are really into them, and there are a number of people, like Yaakov Emden says, that a person should say them every day and memorize them and learn them, etc., etc. Yeah.
It's also by the Rambam's grave,
the Ani Ma'amins. Yeah, they put it there, exactly. But we will be making a big mistake by reading the Ani Ma'amins and thinking that's what the Rambam definitely says. Because it's not the Rambam that wrote them, and they're written in Hebrew, and he didn't write in Hebrew, etc., etc. And by the way, there are 2 versions of the Ani Ma'amins, there's an Ashkenazi and a Sephardi version. There's only 1 version of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, the Rambam's version. But there are 2 versions of the Ani Ma'amins. I'll come to your question in a minute, Reba. And let me just point out to you that there are big differences between them. Look on page 5, for example. They're very, very similar. They have the same 13 principles, the Ani Ma'amins, Sephardi and Ashkenazi. but they're in a slightly different order. You'll see in the Sephardi version that God knowing everything that man does comes as number 6 rather than number 10 in the Ashkenazi version. But let me point out a very big difference. Look in the middle of, just after source 6 there, where I put Nusach Sephardi. So what is the Nusach Sephardi about Torah being from Min HaShemayim? So in the Ani Ma'amin that the Sephardim say, they say, V'sheha Torah Nesuna Min HaShemayim. That we believe the Torah was given from heaven. Okay? The Ashkenazi version says, I believe with a total faith that every part of the Torah that we have today, that's the same Torah that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, if you think about it, that actually there are two quite different statements. In the Sephardi, I'm on page 5, just after source number 6. In the Sephardi version, they say that we are required to believe that God gave the Torah to Moshe, and that Moshe didn't make it up. And that the Torah that was given to Moshe came totally from Shemayim. But of course, that doesn't say anything about whether the Torah that we have today is exactly the same Torah that was given to Moshe. Is it or isn't it? Okay, it's a discussion. It is, but how do we know? Whereas the Ashkenazi version wants to make the claim that no, the Torah that we have today is exactly the Torah that was given, the same Torah is given to Moshe Ben Hashemayim. And again, there are two subtly but very important differences between the two. So don't get too hung up on the Ani Ma'amin, because I don't really care too much what the Ani Ma'amin say. I care what the Rambam says, because he was the one that wrote the original version. Yes?
So isn't there a bit of an impact in the Rambam that the Ani Ma'amin is called the Shabbat Ikra? Is there only like an abridged version?
Yeah, a little bit. I don't think he'd be too happy about it. Because it's quick, because it goes on a page, and because it's something you can say quickly. The Ramban's actual Yud Gimel Ikrim is not something you can just say after Shacharis. It's like a whole limud. You have to sit and go to a course in Medrash Rachel and learn it for a year.
Well, you said it's a poem. I mean, poems
don't have to be
completely...
Okay, it's a poem. Yeah, in other words, it could be that the Ani Ma'amins, when they wrote it, was written as a nice poem to remember, but of course you must go through the Ramban. What it's become is become the kind of final word for most people about what it is. So all I'm trying to do is make sure that you understand that you're not going to be one of those people. You're going to be part of the kind of privileged few that actually get to learn the Rambam.
You'll turn your nose up at those people.
What's that?
You'll turn your nose up at those people.
No, you can't turn your nose up at anybody. But you have to gently remind people that, quote, the Ani Ma'amin does very nice. But you have, of course, read the Rambam in the Judeo-Aramaic, or Arabic, haven't you? If they say, so then, of course, you'll be very nice about it. The other version of the Rambam that we have, the Yud Gimel Ikrim, is Yigdal. Yigdal really is a poem, and we sing it. It's a song. We sing it in shul. And in Israel, they don't sing it that much, and I don't like that, because I like the song. But in England, when I grew up, they sang it at the end of, you know, every Shabbos service, and on Yom Tov and on Rosh Hashanah, different tunes and different things. I think it's a really nice poem. And Yigdal is, I brought it for you at the bottom of the page here, Yigdal Elohim Chai, and it's a very beautiful poem. But again, so we don't know who wrote it. Again, there is an opinion that says the Rambam wrote it. That's probably not true. But it appears it's a bit older than the Ani Ma'amins. It appears a couple of hundred years before then. It's attributed to someone in the 1300s. But it seeks to summarize them, and you can read it yourself. And as we go through it, you can cross-reference and see whether you feel that these poems are more like what the Rambam says or not like what the Rambam says, etc., etc. So just be aware that they are the, if you like, popular versions of the Yud Gimel Ikrit. Questions? Thoughts? Ideas? Yes? It depends on the minhag. It depends on the custom in shul. Most shul say Yigdal at the end of the Friday night service. Once a week. Yeah, I think again, if you look in the Siddur, it usually appears at the beginning of Shacharis. It appears at the beginning of Shacharis. But don't get too hung up about the Siddur and how things are printed, because the way things are printed in the Siddur sometimes depends on just the publishers and what they wanted to print. And people like selling Siddurim because they make money out of them. For example, you know, going out and buying the Art Scroll Women's Siddur. That's very nice. But it's exactly the same as normal Siddur. They just kind of marketed it as a women's Siddur so they can sort of sell it. It's got some useful bits in it. It's got some halachas in it. Although the halachas are a bit hashkafic, and you need to kind of... What's that?
They've
taken out the bits, like, because of course it's too difficult to expect you to just turn the page that deals with tefillin. So you have to have it taken out. You're right, they've taken out a few bits. But, you know, maybe they're frightened you might wear tefillin if you read normal tefillin. It's got a pink cover. What's that? Oh, the Koran Siddur. Yeah, that's another reason Siddur. The font changed, and they...
No. The new translation.
The arrangement. They've reformatted it. And some of it hasn't got commentary. There's the Koran Siddur with Rabbi Soloveitchik's comments on the bottom, and there's the Siddur with Rabbi Sachs's commentary on the bottom. Yeah, I agree. But at the end of the day, the Siddur is a Siddur is a Siddur is a Siddur is a Siddur. And it hasn't changed for an awful long time. There are very slight differences between the Ashkenazi and the Sephardi Siddur. Very slight. They sound different when you walk into the shul. It sounds like, you know, if you're not used to it. But you quickly, actually, if you look at the Siddur, you realise it's almost the same Siddur. And there are very, very subtle differences. Because the Siddur was formulated very early in Jewish development, before the Ashkenazi and the Sephardi split. And therefore we have more or less the same one. Yeah.
About Yisrael, I mean, I was in school, and this one who's very Sephardi and very mystical told me that there's not a good thing at night.
Have you ever heard
something like that?
Sephardi? I don't know.
Not say a lot of things at night. Yeah.
There is an idea of, this is what I do know. I don't know if it's right or wrong. I mean, the fact that I never heard it before doesn't mean it's right or wrong, because I never heard it before. It may be a Kabbalistic idea, it could be. There is definitely an idea that Kabbalistically, the one's not meant to learn written Torah at night. That nighttime is the time to learn oral Torah, and the daytime is the time to learn written Torah. And there are people, therefore, that we never lane at night, except on Simchas Torah, and there are people that think that's not right, they shouldn't lane on Simchas Torah at night. Laning is always during the day. And there are people who don't even say Tehillim at night because of that. But I've never heard this idea that not to say Yigdal at night. I've never heard that before. What's that? We do what the Simchas Torah? We Simchas Torah, we lay. We learn Torah all night.
Yeah,
well, that's mostly oral Torah. We learn, you know.
Yigdal is oral Torah.
No idea. Ask her. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying I never heard it before, which is fine. But, okay, fine. If there are any other questions, please ask. Otherwise, we will leave it there. And we will continue this Be'ezat Hashem in 2 weeks, when we will do part two of the introduction. Because I'm not here next week, sorry.
Sorry, I misquoted. It was Sir Jonathan Sacks who wrote it.
Ah.